Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Journalism has played a prominent role in the Me Too era. Since the revelation in the New York Times of the accusations of sexual assault and harassment against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, more and more survivors have spoken out publicly about their experiences. And many of those have turned to reporters with their stories. Crosscut invited three journalists who have investigated some of those allegations to discuss the challenges of that reporting, the responses to it, and the impact that the Me Too movement has had on their work and our culture at large. Emma Brown has been an investigative reporter at the Washington Post since 2009. She broke the story of Christine Blasey Ford's accusation that then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her while they were both in high school. She's currently on leave from the paper to write a book called How to Raise a Boy, Rethinking Gender in America After Me Too. Sydney Brownstone is a staff reporter at the Seattle Times. Before that, she was online editor at public radio station KUOW, where she published a story involving rape accusations against Seattle music mogul Dave Minert. While a staff writer at Seattle alt-weekly The Stranger, she won the Society of Professional Journalists Western Washington Journalist of the Year Award for her reporting on sexual assault. Rachel LaCourte is a correspondent with the Associated Press. She has been covering Washington state politics since 2005, where she's broken several stories involving allegations of sexual harassment and assault. She is the winner of several awards, including the Associated Press Media Editor's Journalism Excellence Award. She moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and Waldron. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this panel today. As noted, we're talking about reporting in the Me Too era. And the Me Too era, as we know it, started in October of 2017 when the allegations against Harvey Weinstein were republished. The social media campaign began shortly thereafter and exploded with women sharing their experiences with sexual harassment and assault. Similar stories were reported out of various industries, business, media, entertainment, and politics. In the last year alone here in Washington State, four state lawmakers either lost their elections or resigned amid allegations of sexual harassment and assault. So today's panel will discuss some of the challenges related to reporting stories like these and how the reporting has and will continue to evolve. So I'm going to start with Sydney. Sydney, can you talk a little bit about why you think Me Too has resonated in the way that it has?
Well, I think that one of the things that perpetuates gender-based violence is when information is siloed. We kind of all keep these stories to ourselves, and the nature of social media is that you can connect with a million other people from all over the world. And I don't think there would be Me Too without a movement like Black Lives Matter, where people kind of coalesce around these social issues and start to share their individual stories and feel empowered. That I think that strength in numbers thing is a huge motivator for women telling their stories, and not just women, men too. I think the other thing that kind of spilled over is that for a long time we've thought about rape and sexual violence as this thing where it's a stranger who jumps out of the bushes with a knife, and recognizing that it's actually oftentimes people that we know, people in positions of power, I think it kind of opened the floodgates and allowed people who felt like this was just the way the world was to recognize that it's not okay, maybe, and start to tell their stories.
What are your thoughts, Emma?
Totally agree with everything Sydney just said. And also, I think there was a movement years before the Me Too movement on college campuses to raise awareness and to make change around sexual assault, right? And I think that those young people who did that work, which led, you know, pushed the Obama administration to issue a letter urging colleges to crack down in 2011. So that was quite a bit before before the Harvey Weinstein story, right? But those young people, I think, set the stage and made issues like consent something that was we were able to talk about, that we had a language for, and that wasn't foreign. And so that when we got to this point, when, you know, in the aftermath of the 2016 election, when women's political energy was really one of the big stories of what was happening in politics around the country, so that when those stories broke, along with social media, like this whole, we were sort of primed for this, I think, to take off and accelerate.
And Emma, you first reported on Christine Blasey Ford's assault accusation against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And she first reached out to the Post through a tip line and did not want to be identified or go on the record. So can you talk generally about how you navigate a story like this, especially when you're dealing with a reluctant source?
Yeah, I think, I think in building trust with people who have something hard that they have been carrying, that they're considering telling, one of the most powerful tools we have as journalists is our ability to listen, and our ability to listen really actively. Because if you think about it in your life, like how often do you sit down with somebody who is intently listening to you and asking you about your experience moving through the world? Like it just doesn't, for most of us, I think, doesn't happen all that often. And there's great power in that, I think, to help build trust. I guess another thing is, I think, sort of being able to let go of the story being your story as a journalist is important. I think when people have a story of sexual violence or a story that they're sharing with you, it's important to me anyway to remember that it's not my story, and they may never want to tell that story publicly. So in the case of Dr. Ford, as I wrote in the story, she had decided by Labor Day she was not going to tell that story publicly, and I, you know, had to be okay and was okay with that story not being my story to tell. She eventually changed her mind, obviously, but I think as reporters, like that's an important part too. And the last thing I'll say is, I think it's really important to be upfront with sources about who you are and what you're doing. Like, you're not an advocate for them. You are not their friend. And you're not there to promise that they're going to make change in the world. Like, you just can't promise those things and good faith, and that's not really your job as a journalist anyway. Your job is to try to get as close to the truth as you possibly can. So being upfront about that, about the fact that you're going to fact check as much as you can about what they're telling you, that you're going to ask them other questions, potentially uncomfortable questions about their past, to make sure that you're able to disclose everything that you possibly can in the story, that kind of upfrontness, I hope, helps build trust because people understand kind of the process that they're entering into.
And Sydney, you reported on rape accusations against Seattle music mogul David Minor. You talked to multiple women. Can you talk a little bit about what we just talked with Emma about, dealing with some sources? Were some of them reluctant? And how did you get people to tell you some really intimate information?
Well, I think I got lucky in the sense that I had been reporting on these kinds of stories since around 2016. And I think that once you write and report one of these stories, your inbox and your phone immediately fill up with a lot of other stories, and you kind of become the go-to sexual assault rape reporter, because once people see that you can be trusted with one story, they'll keep coming to you. So I think I had that going for me, but it was tough. The story started out with one tip from one woman. She connected me to another woman. A third tip came in anonymously, just through email. I asked her if there was anyone else who may have had a similar experience, and she was able to remember the first name, but not quite the last name of maybe someone else, but I was able to track her down and write her a letter. So I had four, and the fourth woman swore that she knew someone else had filed a police report at some point. So I put in a public records request for all police reports associated with David Minor between January 1st, 2008 and the present. And the only thing I got back were bar fights at his establishment. So nothing helpful, but my source was adamant that there was something out there. So I went to the King County Prosecutor's Office, and I put in another records request, and this time I got back a decline memo. What a decline memo is it's the note that the prosecutor writes to explain why they are not filing charges against a suspect. So with that, I had five women, but it was tough because none of them wanted to use their names. And every publication has their own editorial standard, whether this is okay. I started reporting the story at The Stranger, which is a local alt weekly, and I was told that we would not publish the story unless they were willing to be named on the record. But that was different at KUOW, which is where I ended up publishing the story.
And you did, after your story came out, you did tweet that you had to fight to publish it in a responsible way. Does that entail what a little bit of what you've talked about? And can you talk about how what you felt was responsible and what you had to do to ensure that?
Yeah, so I've never actually told this story publicly before, so this is a little nerve-wracking for me. But I think the same way that Emma talked about trust between a reporter and a source, I think there has to be trust between a reporter and their institution. And when I first heard about this story at The Stranger, my trust was already kind of on shaky ground for a number of reasons. But shortly after I started reporting, my publisher came to me and said that Meinert wanted to have lunch with him. And this was very, very early days reporting. I didn't really have anything there yet. And I thought that was a bad idea, especially if the possibility was there that the story might come up. But I was overruled on that. He said, this is going to happen, and there's a possibility that we might talk about the story. And I said, well, if you're going to talk about the story, I think it's important that I report on it. At which point I was told that he decides what goes into the story and what stays out. I think that every reporter has a line, like a kind of ethical line about where they feel comfortable, or a kind of hard line in the sand, what is not okay to cross. And for me, that was the line where I felt, this is not okay. Meinert was an advertiser with The Stranger. He had personal relationships with some of our staff. I did not feel like it would be the responsible thing to my sources to publish the story under those strictures at The Stranger. So I went back to my sources and I said, it might be a while before I end up publishing this. I'm committed to reporting as much as I can, but I don't know what will happen. So I kind of slow walked it. And I got hired at KOW. I didn't think that I was going to even publish the story there. I thought, you know, maybe I'll keep reporting. Maybe I'll come up with more names, more women. But I was talking to my editor one day, and she's like, well, do you have any long-term story ideas? And I said, well, I've been working on this thing. I don't know if it's ready to go. And she said, you have a responsibility to finish telling it here. So that's what happened.
Like you noted, you'd been reporting on these issues long before Me Too. I think probably all of us have reported to some extent on Me Too-related issues before there was a name for it. So what was it about 2017 and all the reporting that followed the Weinstein reporting that made things different, that opened the floodgates in a way that we had not seen previously? Emma, let's start with you.
I think some of it is that sort of what we were talking about before with the ground was primed because of women's political energy and social media and college activism. But I think, you know, what has been pretty surprising to me and pretty great is how, so let me back up and just say when the Weinstein stories broke, I was on maternity leave. I had just had a baby boy. And so I was sort of sitting at home, nursing him, like scrolling through these pretty horrifying stories and wondered then, it, like could not have imagined then that now in May 2019, we would still be seeing like such a flood of stories. If you look back, like last year, the Pulitzers were just awarded, right? So last year, the New Yorker and the New York Times won for their Weinstein work. My colleagues at the Washington Post won an award for their work on Roy Moore. But this year, there was just as much great work, if not more, around Me Too issues. There was the LA Times with their work on the USC gynecologist who had violated hundreds of women over 25 years. There was a finalist from the Kansas City Star who wrote about institutional sexism and misogyny. There was Liz Brunig, my colleague at the Washington Post, who wrote an incredibly harrowing and gorgeously written piece about the rape of one of her high school classmates and like the complicity of all the people who, including herself, who had like looked away as this girl was ostracized and bullied and disbelieved. And there was a book finalist Bernice Young, whose book was about domestic workers and janitorial workers and farm workers, women who are often overlooked. So, and then just one more, like if you haven't listened to the podcast, Believed from Michigan about Larry Nassar, like I listened to that as I was driving to Pennsylvania one day, and I was that person on the highway who was sobbing as she's driving, and you're like, is she okay? but just the flood of work that has continued since then, at that moment when I was sort of sitting there with my baby scrolling through, I never would have anticipated. And I don't really have a good answer for why that's so, but I think that it has now almost become like this established lane of reporting that's not going to go away.
Sydney, what have you seen just from being based here in the state and seeing kind of some of the stories that have been coming out of Washington State? What do you think helped create this? We've heard so many more stories about women who have come forward, whether it's in media or in politics. Do you think that it basically there was strength in numbers once women saw other people coming forward and putting their names out there? They then felt less ostracized and that they were able to come forward with their story.
I've absolutely seen that, even in the Meinert story. So, for example, you know, I had five women, none of whom were willing to use their names on the record. But I published that first story, six more women came forward, and all of them were willing to use their names. I don't think that would have happened without the first five. I also think the other thing that we're seeing is that more and different types of behavior are being reported. Something that I often find in interviewing sources is they'll tell me a story, and they'll say, but I don't really know if that's sexual assault. I don't know. You know, it's just kind of how it is. You know, men are kind of like this. You know, maybe I'm crazy. But the more they see stories where other people are calling certain behaviors sexual assault and aren't being called crazy, they say it kind of makes them reframe their own experiences in light of that. And I think it's sometimes really uncomfortable because you have a lifetime of lived experience. Not all of us want to look back on everything and say, oh, wow, that was actually really horrible. So I think it's tough a lot of the time. That I don't know if that really, that kind of went into a different lane. I'm sorry.
No, and it actually goes into my next question. Is there anything about the reporting or response either from officials or the public to some of this reporting that has surprised you?
I think what surprised me the most actually in response to the Meinert story is the overwhelming public support for the women in my story. That's definitely something I did not expect, because when I started reporting around these issues, you know, I would have a story and I would go to an editor and the editor would say, well, why didn't they take this to the police? And that would immediately be a kind of, maybe this story isn't worth telling. And we've come so far since then. Granted, we're in Seattle, a very liberal bubble, but not necessarily. I mean, you'll remember the accusations against Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. He remained mayor for 6 months after those initial allegations came out. And, you know, politicians in our very liberal progressive bubble were saying, well, I wouldn't want to be judged for something I did 35 years ago. So I think the thing that surprised me most is the pace of change. And that doesn't necessarily mean like a deep-seated cultural deprogramming, but more of the recognition like, oh, that's not okay to say anymore. I didn't think it would happen that fast.
Was there anything that surprised you in the course of reporting on the Kavanaugh story?
I didn't know what to expect when, you know, after we sort of pressed publish. And so I was surprised. Would have been surprised no matter what happened. Because I didn't know what to expect. But so now I'm on leave from the paper and I'm working on a book about raising boys after Me Too. And so I've been going around the country talking with young people, boys and girls, mostly boys, and their families and their teachers and their coaches. And I guess what surprises me now is about that story is that it became, I think it opened up conversation among young people and among young people and their families about these issues. And beyond just the story that I worked on, I think that all of these stories and sort of the Me Too movement writ large I have been heartened to hear from young people that while they don't agree on everything, like there's a lot of debate and disagreement among young people too about all of this stuff. But you know what? They're having the conversation, a lot of them, and they're talking about what consent means and what that looks like. And that was a conversation. I'm 40. That was a conversation nobody was having when I was in high school. So I think that the way that it is trickling into not every young person's life, certainly, but into a lot of conversations among teenagers and middle schoolers and even elementary school students. I mean, my daughter's 4. She goes to public preschool in Washington, D.C., and she had a lesson in consent this year, talking about, you know, asking permission to hug, asking permission to touch another kid's body. That's incredible. That is a sea change to me and is really hopeful, a point of hope for me as I sort of like look toward the future.
Let's talk a bit about how to vet stories like these. There's a multitude of ways for somebody to come forward with their story, whether it's the old-fashioned way of before social media to kind of reach out to a reporter and relay what occurred to you. But now in the era of social media, we're seeing more social media accusations. We had one here in Washington State last year concerning a state senator. So when you're dealing with the public immediacy of a social media accusation, what are some of the steps that you feel must be taken before you're comfortable with publishing, even if that social media accusation is out there and the mainstream media has not yet responded? And Sydney, I'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. So I think in an ideal world, you have a source who comes to you. They give you a bunch of contemporaneous people they told at the time of the alleged assault. They have a police report that they filed. Maybe a prosecutor filed charges. They have a therapist who's willing to confirm that this person has been telling the same story consistently for a number of years. Maybe there's physical evidence. I mean, really, you're doing your own kind of investigation, right? Only we're not bound by the law, right? It doesn't have to reach a certain standard of evidence. But oftentimes, that's not the way it works. I think it would be helpful to look at what actually happened here with Candace Faber's allegation against Senator Joe Fain. So that was not ideal for me as a reporter. Candace had actually come to me after I published the Meinert story, and she came to me and told me her story and said, I'm not willing to go public yet. The reason I'm telling you this is because I want to see if there are other women out there. There were no other women out there. And so respecting her choice not to go public, I thought, okay, well, this is in the back of my mind, but I'm going to continue reporting on other things. When she was watching the Blasey Ford testimony, she tweeted that she had been raped by Senator Joe Fain. Senator Joe Fain denies this vehemently, but at that point, I thought to myself, oh God, should I have been actively reporting this and preparing for this moment? I have absolutely nothing. But I went back to her, and I basically tried to put together a story with what she had told me. I spoke to her parents, who were there the day after she said she was raped. They were able to fill in a lot of the blanks. I was able to confirm a lot of the basic information and place both Senator Joe Fain and Candace at the same place at the same time. I was able to speak to her friends, to her coworkers, who told me that she had been telling the same story for years. And at that point, because it was already out on social media and the Seattle Times had published a story about it, I felt comfortable running the corroborating information that I had. But had I not already spoken to Candace a month prior, I don't think I would have been in a position to do that. On the other hand, social media has also really helped me develop stories. In 2016, I published a story about this local tech freelancer named Matt Hickey, and the first allegation against him actually was a Facebook post. And then a bunch of women started commenting on that Facebook post saying, this was before Me Too, but Me Too. And so I was able, with that, I was actually able to take my time and talk to all these women and kind of unravel this really bizarre and complicated and fascinating story and then publish when I felt comfortable. It wasn't, with that Facebook post, I think the original poster took it down shortly after, so I had that luxury, but it's hard.
And Emma, how do you deal with it? What's your vetting process in general?
Yeah, I haven't dealt with a situation like Sydney where a story breaks and you have to sort of react like that. But I think in general, you know, there's almost become there has been enough stories now and enough time where there are things that we see over and over, like contemporaneous or corroborators and therapist notes and in a lot of the story or some of the stories, settlement documents where someone has been paid. And so I guess, you know, our job is to get as much evidence as we can as reporters and then sit down with our editors and talk about what the responsible thing to do is with that evidence. Do we have enough to publish? Is this not, you know? And that's a tricky, evolving question, I think, for news organizations. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that if you were working like on a crime shift at a newspaper and there was some event of something comes across, you know, from the police, and it turns out to be a domestic violence situation where the newspaper probably wouldn't write about it because that's a domestic thing, you know. And now that has changed a lot, where domestic violence is now seen as like, this is something we need to cover. This is an important issue. This is all related to sexual violence more broadly. And so the shifting norms of like what is news and what is newsworthy is really an interesting and difficult question, I think, for news organizations.
Well, and that was my next question, is how do you handle that uncertainty? And what counts as what you would consider valid information to use in a story? Do you feel like you need to talk to a minimum of like one or two corroborating sort of people who can help fill in the blanks? If you could just talk a bit more about that.
I don't think there's any, there's no hard and fast rule. And that's part of what makes it tricky, because every story is different. Every context is different. The way in which a story comes to you or comes about is different. For example, like with Sydney's example, the fact that that Candace Faber decided to break her news herself in public that way made it different. I think the fact that Lucy Flores wrote her own essay about her experience with Joe Biden turned that into a different kind of story for a newspaper to cover, for example, than had she gone to a reporter and you know, the reporter would then have to wrestle with how to cover that. So those are just all different contexts in which these stories are arising and sort of coming to reporters and news organizations. And the hard thing is there's no rules. So you have to, like, you know, I was going to say muddle through it, but that sounds sort of, I don't think, by muddle, I just mean, like, smart people sit around, smart and really trying to be as ethical as possible people sit together and try to figure out what is the best way forward.
In Sydney, you talked a little bit about the challenge of between two news organizations and getting your story on David Minert published. So how did you handle that? You clearly saw newsworthiness in the story you were pursuing. And how did, when you talked to your editors at KUOW, was there a discussion about like, okay, we need to talk a bit more about what to include, what not to include?
Oh yeah, I mean, that discussion went on for weeks, and it wasn't just a discussion between me and my editors, it was also a discussion between me, my editors, newsroom leadership, the lawyer, going back and forth over drafts multiple times. Do we include this? Do we not include this? And, you know, while we're trying to make these decisions independently, we also have Minert's crisis communication firm, you know, calling my newsroom leadership and trying to quash the story. So in those moments, you're under a lot of pressure, and that's why I think the trust is so important. I trusted my editors. I trusted my newsroom leadership to make the choices that were the most ethical and the most responsible to get the story published.
I'm guessing that I'm not alone in having been threatened to be sued if I published on a story. Did you guys face that in your reporting on this issue, on these issues as well?
I've definitely gotten letters from lawyers, calls from lawyers and crisis communication firms. Yeah, it's a part of the process now, I think.
And do you think that kind of feeds into the overall sort of stigma that surrounded talking about these issues, that maybe in previous years newspapers would be a little more concerned about lawsuits and maybe not pursuing a story if there's any sort of legal ambiguity? Do you think because of the significance of the reporting over these past 18 months, do you think newsrooms are willing to take on a little more, even in the face of of legal challenge. What do you think, Emma?
Well, I think we saw in some of the early reporting that for sure legal threats had quashed stories in the past, right? So I have not experienced that myself, but I think we have seen that in plenty of stories that reporters had been working on stories and had been trying to get something published and had not been able to for whatever reason. And so part of me too thinks that the reason things are changing, not so much because of legal questions, but because of kind of cultural questions and because of what we now consider to be newsworthy. And what we now consider to be newsworthy is different than what we considered 5 years ago to be newsworthy. And I think that might be, in some ways, the bigger shift.
Yeah, I think that newspapers are willing to take lots of risks for stories that they believe in. But it's only been recently that a newsroom leadership has started to see these stories as newsworthy, whereas in the past, it's like, well, you know, this isn't... it's a he said, she said, or something like that. I also think that once they see that stories like these can win Pulitzers, the game has changed a little bit.
Sometimes in journalism, we report out a story and it just doesn't pan out. And that's a frustrating part of journalism, but I think it's an equal part of what being a credible journalist is. Sometimes you don't report the story. Have you guys been confronted with that, where you just didn't have enough information, or you just felt there wasn't enough information to publish?
I feel like that's a lot of my job, actually. I'm on a team now at the Post called our Rapid Response Investigative Team, and so our mission is to kind of respond to the news and get beneath like whatever the sort of daily news is and try to get a little deeper, and also to take tips and story leads and see where they go. And a lot, you know, it's not unusual for me to spend quite a bit of time on something and then decide, this isn't a story that I can, it's either not a story or it's not a story I can get to the standard that we need it to be at in order to publish. And like, what I really would love people to understand about how journalists work is that we do, like, we have high bar for publication. And you know, in the era of fake, being called fake news, it can be frustrating because we actually, to hear that, because we do have a high bar. And, you know, we also, like, sort of just for self-preservation, need to be super skeptical people. In the last couple years, my colleagues who worked on Roy Moore, some of you might remember, like, they were approached by Project Veritas with a story that was not true about Roy Moore. And, you know, because they were great skeptical journalists, they realized that this was not a true story, and they, instead of publishing the story that was being pitched to them, published a story about how they were being pitched a fake story. And then more recently, I think there was an attempt to plant a fake story about Pete Buttigieg, whose name I never say right. But so, you know, as the one of the worst things a journalist could do would be to publish a story that is cooked up, that would destroy your professional reputation. So yes, we need to not publish in order to, for like our own sort of self-preservation, and in order to maintain the standards of journalism. It's like, just by definition, there's going to be so many stories that we do not publish.
Do you agree, Sydney?
Yeah, everything that Emma said. Also, I think that what's been happening over the last few years, and I mentioned this before, is every time you publish a story, your inbox fills up with all these other stories that, you know, for whatever reason, don't meet your standard of publication. Maybe it's not about a public figure. Maybe they didn't tell anyone until just now. Do you feel comfortable running a story in which there's no kind of corroborating sources over the years? I don't know. So, yeah, there are lots of stories out there that aren't being told right now.
And Emma, you mentioned earlier the essay that was written by Lucy Flores concerning Biden, and there seems to have been a bit of backlash, Me Too backlash, which we had seen in earlier months, but especially concerning the Biden stories. What do each of you make of people saying, okay, now Me Too's gone too far, and being upset about stories like Biden hugging people, or I think smelt her hair, or, you know, the other things that were brought up in that essay? Is this a natural sort of like correcting back to where people are like, okay, we had this bit of reporting and now they're going to try to critique it more maybe than they did at the beginning?
Yeah, I think that everybody can be on board with like violent rape and serial sexual assaulters being wrong. And where the questions get really sort of interesting and the debate gets interesting is around something more like Joe Biden, right? Or more like, I don't know, where people feel like they're not so sure that that's wrong. So I think it's like a natural debate to be having about what is newsworthy, and it's related to, I mean, it's related to so much, but it's related to, I think, the difference between seeing Me Too as a movement of people saying we have not been heard, our experiences have not been validated and have not been listened to, versus people seeing Me Too as a movement about sexual assault and rape or sex, and like those are two different things. And if you are in the first camp, then Lucy Flores' story makes a lot of sense in the context of Me Too, because she's saying this person didn't understand, you know, didn't think about what it was like to be me in that situation. But if you're in the other camp, it doesn't feel like this is even related to Harvey Weinstein. Why are we talking about it? So yes, I think it's a natural debate to be having, and a good one for us to be having, you know, a good national dialogue to be having.
Sydney, do you think people have been looking for a reason to kind of push back on Me Too and are using the stories like the Biden story to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been hearing, has Me Too gone too far since the very beginning? So I think that's a common refrain, but I do think it's a good debate to be having, and I think that there are a couple of different ways to look at this, right? One way to look at it is the women who say they felt uncomfortable by Biden's behavior, you could look at it and say, well, does that behavior actually traumatize someone? And if it doesn't traumatize someone, why are we talking about it, right? And I think even women, a lot of women feel this way. I've dealt with a lot worse. Why are we giving airtime to this? You know, it's not just men who are saying, well, we should be able to do whatever we want. But to me, I think the more productive conversation is, what should the standard of behavior be for men? So it's not about whether, you know, he smelled your hair and then you had to go to therapy. It's about, was it okay for him to smell your hair? Is that the standard of behavior we should expect from our elected officials? And so I think that, you know, every time we kind of steer the conversation towards there, we actually reach a place where we can say, well, I think it's okay, or I don't think it's okay, and then we can talk about it instead of trying to play oppression Olympics or something like that.
And I think, are we right at the Q&A time? Or okay, so we're going to switch over to Q&A. I think all of you have been submitting some questions that I will hopefully be able to access here. All right, I should have brought my reading glasses. Apologies. So we have a question here from someone who asks for you all to talk about why it's important for reporters to acknowledge Tarana Burke, the founder of Me Too, and other women of color's contributions to the movement.
Yeah, I'm glad whoever asked that, I'm glad you asked that, because Me Too was around a long time before Harvey Weinstein's stories broke, and was it Alyssa Milano who then tweeted Me mm-hmm. Too? Yeah, so, why is it important? Because far too often, women of color's voices are not heard and are sort of overridden. And so, in this case, I think what I really appreciate about some of the reporting, including some of the reporting that has not gotten as much attention as the reporting, for example, on sort of the rich and famous, is that it is about it is about people who sort of labor in the shadows a lot and are not heard. And her movement, 10 years that she started 10 years ago, was bringing awareness to those women, to the women that too often aren't heard. So, I mean, I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the chance to acknowledge that this is not a new idea that came about 2 years ago or 18 months ago.
I think it's also important to acknowledge that, you know, the more marginalized you are, the more subject you are to being abused by systems of power, and that can range from sexual violence to the criminal justice system. And I do think that there is some injustice in, you know, the fact that it was a story about rich white women written by a rich white man that kind of got the broader attention, when there have been stories, so many stories over the years about women of color, and also told by women of color, that have been kind of ignored. One that's coming to mind is about this police officer who was preying on black sex workers. I think this was in Ohio, but he had a long list of victims, and that was a story that kind of popped up in the headlines, but then quickly kind of dissipated. It's an ongoing injustice. Newsroom's so white.
Another question is, tips like this have been coming into journalists' inboxes for decades, maybe to a lesser degree, but what has changed in the newsrooms to let them be listened to now? And I will just say that we haven't been ignoring these stories. I think the challenge has been people wanting to give you more information or to go on record or to even be named. And I can tell you at the Capitol, the AP is the lead plaintiff right now on a lawsuit that was started before Me Too, and I had been researching it long before Me Too because of stories I had been hearing but could not verify out of the Capitol. So in our case, our last recourse was filing a lawsuit to try to get at some of these sexual harassment stories and complaints. I think for myself personally that we try to handle all of these stories as responsibly as we can, but sometimes we don't have all of the information. So we fight in different ways to get that. Media Coalition of 10 right now is suing to get those records from the state capitol. Other people are, you know, writing, like Sydney was noting, she's been writing these stories since before 2016, but I'll let you guys speak to that. But I don't think it's a matter that we've been ignoring it. I just think that there are a lot of boundaries in place, and especially people in power have a way of putting obstacles up, whether it's citing a law that they say they're not subject to, which is not the case, or whether it's a threat of a lawsuit. So what are your guys' thoughts?
I agree with you that, you know, so for this book that I'm working on, I've been going back and reading a lot of older, you know, from the last 10 years, reporting on sexual harassment and assault in K-12 schools and colleges, and also just generally, and have been astonished at how much there was. And so it didn't get the kind of white hot attention that reporting on these issues is getting now. Maybe it didn't get the audiences, and there may not have been quite the volume, but there was a lot going on, and a lot of really difficult and important work that was done on these issues long before kind of this intense era that we're in now. So, I mean, I do think that the asker of that question is right, that those tips may now, I mean, I don't know if you could run, you can't run for president now probably without somebody looking into this question in your past, right? And I don't know that that would have been, I don't think that, I wasn't covering national politics a decade ago, but I don't know that that would have been the case then.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to the question of the changing discussion around what is newsworthy. I don't think that the stories we've been publishing today necessarily would have been published 3 years ago. So I think it's about that, those changing cultural norms, but again, Pulitzer. You can win a Pulitzer with this kind of storytelling, and maybe that's not something that editors and newsroom leadership realized before.
Another question is that audiences have short attention spans, and the trend in journalism is to produce increasingly shorter content. How do you give complex stories like these the necessary depth? Do you guys have word limit issues, either of you? I know I do.
I'm really fortunate right now in that I don't at all. I'm in a weird position in which I'm writing for the web at a radio station, so I can kind of do whatever I want, and that's a really unique place to be, so I'm not subject to word length limits. But I will say this, I think that the pendulum is swinging from, you know, short, clickbait, grabby stuff to investigative journalism. And I don't know when it's going to swing back, and I don't know how long it's going to stay over here, but I see investment here, and it makes me really hopeful.
I totally agree. And I think if you look, like in the audio space, podcasts and that kind of narrative storytelling are super popular and growing so quickly right now. And in print, as you said, the investigative journalism, I mean, the story of journalism overall, it can feel like a pretty depressing one when you look at the disappearance of local news. But I think there are a lot of outlets that are realizing that they get loyalty and therefore subscription dollars when they produce journalism, investigative and long-form journalism.
A question on the impact of having men as well as women reporting on Me Too. Do you make any special efforts to include or exclude the male perspective on Me Too? And I guess I would just start by saying Ronan Farrow did a lot of the Me Too reporting early, so he was certainly a very prominent male reporter who was reporting on this. How about in your newsrooms? Are men reporting on these issues as often as women?
Well, in the radio world, Austin Jenkins, who reports for the Northwest News Network and KOW and a lot of our radio stations, has been doing great Me Too reporting out of the State House. And I'm really encouraged to see that, actually, because I think that it's really easy to slip into a niche of, oh, you're the woman rape reporter. Every time we get a story, it's going to go to you. And that can feel like a burden, especially, and it can feel really isolating, too. So I think the more we have men reporting on this, the better.
How about you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The more, I think both men and women can do a good job, an awesome job on Me Too stories. At the Post, the team that worked on the Roy Moore stories included women and men. And it was women who were in Alabama talking with the women who were accusing Roy Moore in that case. But the men who were, there were quite a few men involved in other parts of the reporting that were hugely important for telling the full story, as I said, not just of Roy Moore, but of attempts to undermine the Post's reporting afterwards on Roy Moore. Yeah, team effort.
There is a question about women in the newsroom and how that's impacted coverage on stories like these. This person writes that 2/3 of J-School comm grads, but 1/3 of the women in the industry, less for women of color. And so, and I can speak for myself, I'm often the only woman in the room at political press conferences until my good friend Melissa Santos came to Crosscut and started covering politics again. I was the only full-time female political reporter in the state of Washington, so it was a bit of a lonely place. So I do think there is a perspective that women bring, but I don't know that we would report these stories any differently than our male colleagues, like Austin did with the State House reporting. What are your thoughts on the number, on this, the coverage of this topic, as reflected in the female press corps, of which there's not enough of us?
Well, I think women. I mean, I recognize Ronan Farrow's contribution to this type of storytelling, but I think a lot of women long before him were recognizing that these were stories and were fighting to tell these stories in their newsrooms and may have gotten shut down. So I think it's really important to have a diversity of perspectives in the newsroom because, you know, you'll have different people identifying stories that kind of the white male objective gaze might not necessarily do. I also think that, you know, in criminal justice reporting and oftentimes investigative reporting, it's been viewed as to me, a kind of historically male pursuit. You know, this is kind of like the elite reporting gig that you can get. If you're a woman, oftentimes you're relegated to other beats. Early in my career, when I was working at the Village Voice and blogging about the news of the day, local politics or whatever, you know, I had an editor come sit me down and say, we should leave the politics for the men. I want you to report on fun things for women under 35. So, like Sex and the City, which by that point was already really old. Anyway, he was a little out of touch. But I think that, you know, what this reporting has shown is that women are formidable investigative and criminal justice reporters. And we have access to spaces that men might have a harder time getting access to. I think the first stories that I reported that dealt with sexual assault, I was able to, you know, gain trust because I looked like the people that I was reporting on, and I don't think the impact of that can be understated.
I spent most of my career at the Post covering education, and education reporting is like an overwhelmingly female pursuit. And so it has been a change now to be in the investigative world, which is just generally more male. And I guess what I want to say about that is when I was just starting out in journalism, I think I thought, now looking back, I realized that I thought that was not a space for me. And that what changed that for me was women in leadership positions. I've had awesome male bosses, but women in leadership positions who challenged me to see myself in a role that I wasn't seeing myself in. And so I think it's also real important for there to be mentors who can guide women into positions that they may not otherwise see themselves being in.
Well, that 50 minutes went very fast. I thank all of you for your questions and for your attendance today. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And to sign up for announcements about the next Crosscut Festival, go to crosscut.com/festival. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.